Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. Delighted to be with you on this Tuesday for Open Forum. 2 hours of Open Forum, as a matter of fact. Your calls, welcome. Dialing early is the best way to go because the lines do fill up quite quickly when we do Open Forum. 888-318-7884 is the number, 888-318-7884. And if you are not familiar with Open Forum, it means you can call to ask about anything that you would like to ask about. You got a question about the Bible, got a question about the popes, got a question about the sacraments, got a question about the moral life, you want to know about a church council. You want to know about just about anything, you can call and ask 888-318-7884. You're welcome whether you're Catholic or not. As a matter of fact, we always love it when non-Catholics call and ask if maybe you're something that makes you curious. Maybe there's something that bothers you about the Catholic faith. Either way, you're welcome. 888-318-7884. I'm Cy Kellett, your host and our guest for both hours today. Perhaps a bit unusual for a Tuesday, but he's here to help us out, is Jimmy Akin, senior apologist here at Catholic Answers. Hello, Jimmy Akin.
Howdy, Cy Kellett.
I hope you are well. Thanks for being here with us on a Tuesday afternoon.
Oh, no problem. My pleasure.
And
you know, you were mentioning people can call on any subject. They can also call from anywhere in the world. In fact, if we get callers from outside North America, we try to put them on first.
That is exactly right. Yeah. So please call. And, you know, you can, if you got a weird question or something like that, we did weird questions last Friday. You can always email to us, that kind of thing. We'll try to get to them later. But if you can get through, you're welcome to call from anywhere, anyone, 888-318-7884. Occasionally we're able, you know, because we're doing a radio show, we don't always have time, but if I can monitor Facebook and YouTube a little bit, I'll take questions from there as well. Jimmy, in addition to being senior apologist here at Catholic Answers, is the proprietor of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. And this will be the first new episode will come, that or new topic for a few weeks will come up, because you've just done 3 weeks on the age of the earth. Which turned out to be 43 years. I was amazed that that was the answer. That is not true for those listening.
Think you're off by a factor of 100 million there.
100 million here and there between friends. So what's going to drop this Friday?
We're going to be talking about an event that various seers have talked about called the warning or the illumination of consciences. We're going to look at the evidence that has been cited for it and see how solid it is or how not solid it is.
Everybody's talking about it though, Jimmy. I'm glad you're doing that. That's gained. Okay, cool. All right. We'll look forward to that on Friday. 888-318-7884, the number here. One line open right now. So you maybe you're that person who just wants to sneak in before everybody fills up the lines. 888-318-7884. Because the lines are filling up already, let's head straight to them. We'll go to Anonymous in an anonymous location. And Anonymous, are you there with us?
I am, sir. Hello, Cy.
Hi, Anonymous. Nice to hear from you again. Oh, well, I don't know if I'm hearing from you again, because you might not be the same Anonymous that called yesterday, but Anonymous, your question for Jimmy.
Yes, sir. Thanks a lot. Hello, Mr. Akin.
Howdy.
Yes, hello. So I've been chatting. So I am not myself Roman Catholic, but I do chat with a lot of Catholics, and there seems to be a disagreement concerning the Eucharist. So I'm trying to understand what they believe and what you believe.
Okay.
So there's two. So you've answered this many times. I have to ask again for the audience. So some Roman Catholics that have talked to me, they believe that the sacrifice of Christ has not stopped, even though he's sitting next to the Father, and so during the Eucharist, it is the continuation of the sacrifice that has not stopped. Others believe that it has stopped, and in the now what they cite is in the Roman Catholic Catechism 1323, the perpetuate, they interpret the word perpetuate as in preserve. So the one Christ's sacrifice is done, it's complete and it's finished, but the blood is in heaven, and that is what is being presented during the Eucharist, even though Christ's sacrifice is done. So there is a difference.
So straighten it out. Straighten it out for us, Jimmy. What is the reality?
Well, It sounds to me like the people that Anonymous has been talking to are both expressing aspects of the truth, but neither account is a complete description of the truth. So one of the points that the book of Hebrews makes and that Catholics very much agree with is that Christ only died once. And so he offered himself on the cross in a bloody manner, meaning he died once for all. And that's done. That does not keep happening. Now, there are, in some writings by Catholics, you will occasionally run across a kind of time warp theory that says the Mass is like a time warp that makes exactly what happened on the cross present on the altar. And these writings are not official writings. This is not what you will find in the official documents of the Church. Instead, what you will find is you will find statements in official Church documents stressing that the sacrifice of the Mass is the same as the sacrifice of the cross in several key respects. The primary sacrificing priest is the same, because it's Jesus continuing to offer himself to the Father. The offering is the same, because he's offering himself. And the purpose is the same, namely our salvation, but the manner of offering is different. On the cross, he offered himself in a bloody manner. In the Mass, he offers himself in an unbloody manner. And the Mass is just the earthly outworking of what's actually happening in heaven. So as he's in heaven, depicted in the New Testament as sitting at the right hand of the Father, he continues to intercede for us. And by that intercession, he continues to offer himself to the Father as a living sacrifice. And this is something that's stressed in the 1968 document known as the Credo of the People of God, where Paul VI stressed that Christ is offering his flesh glorified in heaven to the Father. So it's not a new death. It's not a bloody offering. It's not the same sacrifice in that sense, but it is the same sacrifice in these other senses, in that the primary priest is the same, the offering, the thing being offered is the same, and the purpose of the offering is the same. But now he offers himself in a glorified living form to the Father by way of his heavenly intercession. So there's an aspect, there are aspects in which it's the sacrifice continues, but there are aspects in which the sacrifice is different.
Anonymous, I'm going to leave it there and hope that that was helpful to you. Thank you very much for the call. Appreciate it. As I said, lines keep filling right up, so we're going to keep moving. Devante in Odessa, Texas is next. Hi, Devante. No? I know I'm pushing the right button.
Hello, right. Can you hear me?
Oh, there you are, Devante. How are you?
Sorry, I accidentally had you on mute. I'm great. How are you guys?
I do that all the time, Devante. So we're just happy to have you. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Yes, sir. So something I've been studying recently, it's so funny because I'll be studying Catholicism and then I stop and then I start again. The doctrine that I've been studying recently is purgatory. And I've tried to familiarize myself with the Catholic perspective by actually listening to informed Catholics. So what exactly would you guys say is purgatory, and why is purgatory necessary?
Purgatory, according to the Catechism of the Catholic Church, is the final purification that God performs for people who die in a state of grace so that they'll be able to enter the full glory of heaven. Because when we commit sins, even though the guilt of the sin, especially the eternal guilt of the sin, is forgiven, there are consequences that remain. You know, for example, we develop bad habits. And so even if you're forgiven for the bad things you've done, you still have these disordered desires that have been habituated in you, and those need to be fixed before you're ready to be in heaven. We're not going to carry those bad habits with us into heaven. And so consequently, over the course of the Christian life, God gives us his grace, and when we cooperate with it and say, you know, I'm going to resist that habit today. I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to give in to that temptation. We help purify by God's grace, our nature. We grow in holiness. That's sometimes referred to in both Catholic and Protestant theology as sanctification, because it makes us more saintly or holy. And for most people, that's not complete by the end of life. Most of us still have some bad habits at the end of life. We still have some lingering consequences from the things we've done that need to be dealt with. And so at the end of life, between death and the full glory of heaven, God purifies us. He completes the sanctification that he had already began in this life. And that final rush of sanctification, that completion of sanctification, is what is referred to as purgatory, because it purges us or makes us pure. And we're told in the book of Revelation that nothing unclean will enter the heavenly city. And so we do need to be purified. We need to be purged of the remaining consequences of sin, both original and personal, in order to be in God's full presence in heaven. And so that's what purgatory is. The Catholic Church doesn't have teachings about how long this takes. It may happen in the twinkling of an eye. In fact, in his encyclical on Christian hope, Spes Salvi, Pope Benedict said that we can't measure it in earthly time. So, the church doesn't even try to do that. We have to leave that up to God, but based on Revelation, and not just the book of Revelation specifically, but more generally, God's revelation, and based on human experience, which shows us that most people are not pure by the time they die, we reasonably and rationally reason that there must be a final stage to sanctification that comes between death and glory. And that's purgatory.
And you know what, Devontae, our colleague Carlo Bussard has a brand new book coming out, and it's just a couple weeks away from being out. And it's called Purgatory Is For Real, Good News About the Afterlife for Those Who Aren't Perfect Yet. And so, Marie will take your data if you'd like to give it to her, and we'll send it to you. But you'll have to wait. Would you like to do that, Devontae?
I am always down for reading. You never have to ask me if I want a book.
All right. Does it remind you of anything where you know a good thing is coming, but you have to wait for that good thing to come? All right. Hang on.
Dinner time?
Yes. It's, oh, man, dinner. That's a little purgation waiting for dinner. Thanks, Devontae. Hang on. Marie will get your information. We'll send you Carlo's book, Purgatory Is For Real, and we'll be right back with more Catholic Answers Live. Open forum with Jimmy Akin right after this.
Catholic Answers Live.
Exorcisms on Monday and Rapture on Wednesday. That's the calendar this week on Catholic Answers Focus. The official exorcist of the Archdiocese of Indianapolis joins us on Monday to discuss the life of an exorcist, what training he gets, and then some stuff that's probably too scary to mention here. Then on Wednesday, we ask Carlo Bussard about the end times, particularly the rapture. Is there any chance that rapture might be real? Catholic Answers Focus is available on YouTube and wherever you get your podcasts. Get all the details and past shows at CatholicAnswersFocus.com.
Want the latest pro-life news? Want it delivered? Sign up. It's free. EWTN Pro-Life Weekly, your source for everything happening now in the fight to protect the sanctity of human life. New episodes delivered every week to your inbox. So if you really want to know,
sign up today.
Go to EWTN.com/pro-life today.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Open forum. Jimmy Akin, our guest. Before we head back to calls, I want to remind you the annual store-wide sale is underway right now. Items at 10 to 25% off and more, some up to 50%. E-books, MP3s, CDs, books, DVDs, even our School of Apologetics courses are all on sale. You can also get $5 flat rate shipping if you live within the continental United States. Just go to shop.catholic.com and get all those savings today. Shop.catholic.com. Jimmy Akin, our guest this hour, senior apologist here at Catholic Answers, and next on the line to talk with Jimmy is Jason in the Philippines, listening on Catholic.com. Jimmy invited the international calls. Jason, it's nice to have you here with us.
Hi, guys.
Hi.
Thank you. Thank you for accepting my call.
Oh, of course. We're happy to have your call. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Yes. If the partial judgment is supposed to be private or personal, and that the final judgment is supposed to be public, then why are we, or why the church, canonizing and declaring saints publicly?
Okay. So it's true that the particular judgment is something that is private in the sense that it occurs when an individual person meets Jesus in the afterlife and he's judged and his soul either is saved and goes to heaven, often with a stop in purgatory first, or is lost because he's rejected God and ends up going to hell. And this is not manifest to the world. This is something that happens privately. Maybe angels get to look at it, and maybe saints in heaven get to look at it, but we here on earth don't get to look at it. And so it's private from our perspective. At the general judgment, at the end of time, that will be public. Jesus talks about how, you know, what we've done in secret will be proclaimed from the housetops. And so there seems to be a public aspect to that judgment that's different. But just because the particular judgment is private from an earthly perspective, and just because we don't see it happening, you know, because it's a spiritual reality rather than something you could see with your physical eyes, that doesn't mean we can't gain evidence about whether or not someone has passed that judgment and has gone to heaven. In fact, already in the Old Testament, we see passages where God allows departed saints who died in God's friendship to appear to people on earth. In the book of 2 Maccabees, for example, the departed high priest Onias and the prophet Jeremiah both appear to Judah Maccabee. And so consequently, Judah Maccabee received evidence that these guys died in God's friendship and they're in the good place, even though that wasn't strictly the full glory of heaven as we understand it today, because Jesus hadn't died yet. In any event, because Judah Maccabee got evidence that these people were saints, he was able to announce this to others. So even though he didn't witness their particular judgments, he got the evidence he needed to make this announcement to other people. And in the same way, even though we here on earth and, you know, the Pope doesn't see the judgment of a specific individual, we can get evidence that that person did make it to heaven. And one of the primary forms of that evidence is whether or not God performs miracles, verifiable miracles, in conjunction with that person's intercession. Because presumably God is not answering, is not performing miracles for people who are in hell. But if you ask for the intercession of someone and a genuine miracle happens as a result of asking for that intercession, that's evidence the person is in heaven. Now, you still have to face a question of, okay, well, if this person is in heaven, does that mean we want to publicly declare him as a saint? And because if you declare someone a saint, that makes the person an example for the faithful. And so they don't, over at the Congregation for the Causes of Saints, they don't just look at the evidence of our miracles happening in connection with this person's intercession. They also look at the person's life. And if the person lived a life of heroic virtue, they really lived the Christian life to the full, even if they weren't perfect, that makes them a good example to set before the faithful. And so if they've set a good example in this life and there's evidence that they're in heaven because God's doing miracles in connection with their intercession, then that makes them a good candidate for sainthood. And so even though we don't see their particular judgment happening, we can still have evidence that they made it to heaven. And if their example is good enough, the Pope may choose to go ahead and declare them a saint.
Thank you, Jason. I'm going to keep moving. The lines continue full. It's open forum. Jimmy Akin is our guest. Let's go to Universal City in Texas. Patricia, listening on Guadalupe Radio 89.7 FM. Patricia, your question for Jimmy.
Hi there.
Hi.
Yes, and thank you for taking my call. I'm a longtime listener, first-time caller.
Well, thanks for calling.
Me. I'm lifelong Catholic, 60-plus years, and my mother and my grandmother taught me the rosary. And when we said the Hail Holy Queen, when it came to O Clement, O Loving, O Sweet Virgin Mary, we struck our breath. Mm-hmm. I never was told why. I still do it today, but I'd like to know why. And the other thing I noticed is it's only people, I'm going to say 50 and up, that I see doing this. I don't see that it's being taught. And is it something we should be teaching? Because I have nieces and nephews.
Okay. So there is no single way to say the rosary. And in fact, the Hail Holy Queen is not actually part of the rosary itself. It's a prayer that is often added to the rosary, but it is not, strictly speaking, part of the rosary. And so this is an example of how there is no single one right way to say the rosary. There are multiple different ways, which is something that John Paul II acknowledged in his apostolic letter on the rosary, where he proposed the luminous mysteries. He acknowledged that there's no one way to do this, and it varies all over the world and among different groups of people. Some people add certain prayers to the rosary. Some people say the bare thing. Some people add scriptural meditation. So there's a lot of flexibility here. In terms of striking the breast during the Hail Holy Queen, it's a matter of custom. Now, striking the breast is ordinarily taken as a sign of contrition, of saying that one is sorry for one's sins. And so in asking the Virgin Mary to pray to God for us, to be our prayer partner, and you're striking your breast at the same time as saying, O Clement, O Loving, O Sweet Virgin Mary, you're kind of emphasizing her holiness, which she received by God's grace, while at the same time acknowledging our own lack of holiness. And so I would take it as a kind of implicit physical prayer, acknowledging I'm a sinner, I need God's grace. You, Virgin Mary, have received God's grace in an amazing, miraculous way. Please pray for me because of my own limitations. And so I would take it as a kind of enacted prayer, acknowledging our own limitations and what God has done for Mary and asking her to intercede for us. But the striking of the breast, just like saying the Hail Holy Queen itself, is something that's optional. I wouldn't tell other people they have to do it this way because the church doesn't tell them they have to do it this way. But it's certainly a fine thing to do if they want to.
Thanks, Patricia. We're going to head on now to Sonomish, Washington. Watching on Facebook Live is Peggy. Peggy, you there with us?
Yes. My question is, when I'm talking with my Protestant friends about sin and purgatory, one of the things that comes up is Romans chapter 4, verses 5 through 8, where they're talking about faith credited as righteousness and sins are covered, and blessed is the man whose sins the Lord does not record. And the second part to that question is, I believe Jimmy Akin, in the book, The Drama of Salvation, and also in Carl Keating's book, Catholicism and Fundamentalism, the statement was made that the few times the Bible mentions covering sins refer not to the forgiveness of sins by God, but to the forgiveness of one man's sins by another. But there's in neither of those books is there a citation made to the verses that show that example. And so my question is kind of two-part. One, what is meant by how does the Catholic look at sins are covered and not recorded, and trying to explain purgatory and whatever to these friends of mine?
Okay, well, let's deal with the second question first. Now, it's been a long time since I've read Catholicism and Fundamentalism. I don't recall what it may have said on this topic. And even though I wrote The Drama of Salvation, I don't remember everything I've ever written. So I could have said something about this, but I would be pretty surprised if I said that the metaphor of covering for sins is only used with respect to one human being forgiving another human being. That is not my understanding of how this metaphor is used either in the Old Testament or the New Testament. So I wouldn't be supportive of that view. I don't think that the evidence supports it. And in fact, I think that the metaphor, or the, I should say the quotation that Paul gives here in Romans 4 of the Psalms, where the subject is God's forgiveness, I think that would clearly illustrate that the metaphor of covering can be used for divine forgiveness. But as you can hear from that music, we need to go to a break, and so I'll have more to say on the other side.
I hope you can hang on. Peggy, we'll just take a quick break and be right back with more Open Forum with Jimmy Akin, and he'll get to finish his answer for your question.
Stay with us for more Catholic Answers Live.
To many people, even many Christians, purgatory is a fantasy, or worse, a wicked lie invented by the church to make salvation complicated and keep people in fear. But I'm here to tell you that purgatory is fact, not fiction. The Bible supports it, Christians have historically believed in it, and it makes theological sense. In my new book, Purgatory is for Real, I provide the evidence and reasoning to help you understand this controversial doctrine and demonstrate how it's actually a joyful, hopeful reality, not something shadowy and mysterious, but a sign of God's love and mercy. To get your copy of Purgatory is for Real, visit shop.catholic.com today or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Why is it wrong to help someone commit suicide? Don't people have a right to die with dignity rather than being a burden to others? Does the Church teach that the terminally ill must be kept alive by machines for as long as possible? In 20 Answers, End of Life Issues, you'll find smart, solid answers to these questions and many more, helping you unravel the controversies and confusions surrounding euthanasia, assisted suicide, and the rights of patients in our uncertain healthcare future. 20 Answers End of Life Issues is part of the 20 Answers series from Catholic Answers, offering hard facts, powerful arguments, and clear explanations of the most important topics facing the Church and the world, all in a compact, easy-to-read package. Visit shop.catholic.com and take a look at this exciting new series from Catholic Answers Press.
Did you know you can access Catholic Answers Live right from your phone or other mobile device? Download the Catholic Answers Live app today. The Catholic Answers Live app, available now on iOS and Android.
We want to know how our Blessed Mother has aided you during your life.
That's our topic tomorrow on Take Two with Jerry and Debbie on most of these EWTN stations.
Now, more of Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin with us both hours today for Open Forum. And on the line, Peggy in Sonomish, Washington, asking about the fourth chapter of Romans and the idea that does God cover over our sins? And you were in the midst of your answer, Jimmy.
Yeah, so we talked about the fact that, as far as I can tell, the evidence biblically is that when the metaphor of covering sins, because sins are not physical objects, you know, when we sin, there's not a new physical object there that is then physically covered over. So this is a metaphor. And so is not recording sins, to use the phrase that that Peggy used. Other translations will render that differently. They'll say, to whom the Lord does not reckon his sins. And there are other translations yet. But these are two, both the covering and the not recording or not reckoning sin, are two of the metaphors that get used in Scripture for how God deals with us by his grace with respect to sin. And there are others as well. Forgiveness is another one. Forgiveness, you look at the root of the concept, and it's like releasing. So it's a different metaphor. When you forgive something, you release it. Redeeming is another one. when you redeem something, you buy it back. And so God, by redeeming us, buys us back from sin. And there are other metaphors yet, which I do talk about in my book, The Drama of Salvation. Having said that, none of these metaphors should be understood as capturing all of what God does with respect to sin. If any one of them expressed everything God does with respect to sin, then that would be the only metaphor we'd ever need. The fact that there are these multiple metaphors indicates that when God acts in our lives by his grace, it has many different aspects of how he does that. It's kind of like the blind men feeling the elephant. You know, they each feel a different aspect. One of them says an elephant feels like an ear. Another says it feels like a trunk. Another says he feels like a tree because he's holding onto a leg. All of these are different aspects of an elephant that the blind men can feel, but no one of them gives the whole picture. And it would be a mistake to say because an elephant has a trunk that an elephant is just a trunk. And in the same way, when we have all of these different biblical metaphors for what God does by his grace, it would be a mistake to latch on to any one of them and say, well, this tells us everything we need to know. And so when we're looking at these, we need to say, okay, so what is this one metaphor trying to teach us? And when we encounter the covering over metaphor or the not reckoning or not recording metaphor, basically it's saying that in some way we won't be held accountable for these sins. It's another way of saying forgiveness, or, you know, we're going to be forgiven for them. But that doesn't mean that there aren't continuing consequences to sin. As we talked about a little bit earlier, there are continuing consequences to sin. Even after the eternal guilt of a sin is forgiven and we're released from that, we still have impurities to deal with. We've got bad habits that we've built up as a result of giving into temptation. And since nothing unclean is going to enter the heavenly city, as the book of Revelation tells us, we need to be cleaned up. And that's what purgatory is. It's the final stage of sanctification, and where God makes us holy and ready for heaven. That's a process that begins even in this life, as God encourages us by his grace to grow in holiness over the course of the Christian life. And so your Protestant friends, one of the things you can say to them is, look, you would acknowledge that even after we're forgiven, even after our sins are covered, even after God is not reckoning or recording our sins, that we still need to grow in holiness. That's what sanctification is. And if they're normal Protestants, they will believe in sanctification just as much as you do. And so you can say, well, you have some nice verses here in Romans. We've got them in our Bibles too. And they basically talk about forgiveness, but, and they also talk about justification, but they don't cover the issue of sanctification. Sanctification is still a process that we need to undergo. It begins in this life. And from the Catholic point of view, purgatory is simply the last stage of sanctification. And since these verses are not talking about sanctification, they don't deal with purgatory one way or the other.
Peggy, I hope it helps. It's open forum. Jimmy Akin is our guest, and there are lots of folks on the line. So I'm just going to keep going, and you can try if you want, 888-318-7884. But thus far, the lines have stayed pretty full throughout the day. Let's go to Todd in Michigan, listening on Good Shepherd Catholic Radio. Todd, you with us?
Hi, how you doing, guys?
Hi, Todd. Very well, thank you.
Good. I hope you can hear me okay. I'm actually combining soybeans as we speak. But my question is this. I'm a non-Catholic and a lifelong Free Methodist, which is much more conservative. But I'm very curious about the Pope's new evangelization. Now, obviously, to a Protestant, evangelization to us would mean we'd go for maybe a series of evenings of preaching and evangelistic services, telling people about Christ and bringing them to the Lord. And I've been to many Catholic masses, and I enjoy the Catholic Church. And obviously, that's not necessarily the place for evangelization. So my question is, how is the Catholic Church evangelizing, and what does that look like?
Well, we should start by talking about the basic meaning of evangelization. Now, the term gets used different ways, but fundamentally, evangelization is to announce the gospel. And that's going to mean principally announcing the gospel to people who have not yet accepted it. So they may have heard it, they may not have heard it, but you're talking to the unconverted principally. And the Catholic Church does that in a variety of different ways. In some cases, you have people who are evangelists by profession, and they go and announce the gospel in a variety of different ways. They may do it one-on-one by talking to people. They may do it by holding a seminar or a set of talks where it's encouraged to bring the unevangelized in. It may happen these days on social media. It may happen here on Catholic radio. It may happen on Catholic television. But one way or another, the church believes in announcing the basic facts of the gospel of Jesus Christ and what he did for us. And it happens in a wide variety of different contexts. It happens both by professional evangelists and by ordinary Catholics. It happens by priests and by bishops. It's fundamentally a duty of everybody to do what they can in keeping with their circumstances and their talents, to do what they can to announce the gospel to people who need to hear it. And so there's not a single model for doing it. Now, sometimes you will have situations where there is a set of talks that are done either in the evenings or at some other time where Catholics will try to bring in people for these talks. Sometimes that's called historically, it's been called a revival. It's also been called a gospel service. It's also been called a mission. That's a term that you'll hear in some Catholic circles. Evangelization isn't the only function of those, but you will find evangelization done in many of those. But there's more than one model of how it happens. Sometimes evangelization happens through speech. Sometimes it happens through handing out literature. Sometimes it happens through electronic media. There's a bunch of different ways it happens. But the Catholic Church has obviously been doing it because it's the largest body of Christians on the planet.
Todd, there's a little known rule here at Catholic Answers that if someone asks a question while harvesting, they get a follow-up. So do you have any follow-up for Jimmy?
I'm sorry. What was that, Jimmy?
So I wanted to know if you had a follow-up question.
Oh. No, I totally agree with Jimmy. I think that is great. I think John Ricardo was an evangelist. He could have been a great Protestant preacher just as well as a Catholic preacher. I just didn't know if there was something new. If the Catholic Church has been doing that all along, why did the Catholic Church say, well, now we need to evangelize more? We've sacramentalized, but now we need to evangelize more. This needs to be something that we need to do. I didn't know if there was something new that the Catholic Church was trying to do. I'm all about reconciliation for Christians of all denominations.
Okay. So the reason that you hear about a new evangelization is because, and this happens in every age of the church from one degree to another, it's not the Pope saying we've gotten too sacramentalized and we need to get away from that. That is not what the popes have been saying. But there have been shifts in various parts of the world with regard to the Christian faith. This is something that has happened in every period of Christian history. It's always growing in some places, the faith is. It's diminishing in other places. And in recent years, even though it's been growing in places like Africa and Asia, it's been diminishing in places like Europe and North America. And so you have this large body of people who are historically of Christian heritage, but either they're not practicing their faith or their parents just didn't raise them in the faith, and they need to hear the good news. And so the idea of the new evangelization is we want to evangelize these people who are historically from a Christian culture, but it's the passing on of the Christian faith has been flagging in those cultures, and they need to hear the gospel. And so that's why this is considered a new evangelization or a re-evangelization of these people.
Todd, thank you so much. I really, really appreciate the call. We have to take a quick break, however. We'll be right back with more Open Forum with Jimmy Akin after this.
Call now, Catholic Answers Live.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
EWTN, helping people grow in their love and understanding of God.
You know, I was raised Catholic, but then went to the other side and tried to commit suicide a couple of times several years ago. My Savior happened to be a Catholic priest here locally, and I wanted to say, though, surrounding myself with people like yourself and this radio station. This morning I felt kind of alone, and then I was like, oh yeah, EWTN. Oh, I love it.
We have a big problem. Our culture is dying, and souls are in danger of being lost. The answer is conversion to Jesus Christ in His church. St. Paul Street Evangelization is a Catholic organization, and we have hundreds of teams spreading the good news throughout the country. But we need your help. The harvest is great, but the laborers are few. Find out more and get involved today at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
You may or may not be aware of this, but it's election season here in the United States, and Catholic Answers has some resources that are free that we'd like to share during this time, just to help people in there as you're making your electoral considerations, whether on the local, state, or federal level. And so we've got some free stuff that's going to post each day. Today they've got an article and a video, Five Rules for Catholic Politicians. And it's all up at Catholic.com, or all week this week, there'll be a different set of things leading all the way up to Election Day, I guess. We'll continue doing this. So today's article video, Five Rules for Catholic Politicians. Each day you can find these helps to voting at Catholic.com. And as I said, they are free. Jimmy Akin is our guest. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. It is Open Forum today on Catholic Answers. You can call with whatever question you like. No science questions thus far. Jimmy loves science questions, but you know what? Jimmy's a what is it that we say, Jimmy? I know polymath is part of it, but what's the first part of it? I forget. There's a two.
Oh, well, sometimes people point out I'm an autodidact.
Autodidact polymath. Yes, Jimmy's an autodidact polymath, so you're welcome to call with pretty much any question you want. Up next,
I do like science questions. Just before the show, I was answering an email from a priest about prompt supercriticality in nuclear reactions.
I'm frankly sick of priests asking about that. I mean, let it rest, you know? All right. Jafet in Gainesville, Georgia, watching on Facebook Live. You are next. Your question for Jimmy.
Oh, hey, guys. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Yes, I just had a question. I used to be part of a Pentecostal oneness church, and I guess like the core belief of that church was that Jesus Christ is the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. You know, I guess what we would call modalism, right?
Right.
And
one of the terms.
Yeah, one of the terms. And another big thing was the baptismal formula in the name of Jesus Christ. And I recently converted to Catholicism maybe like a year ago.
Great. And wonderful.
Yes. And, I still have communication with my friends, back at the little community. And I guess a lot of times when we have like a dialogue or something, like one of their favorite scriptures, which I know by memory because that was what was taught to me, is from Isaiah chapter 9 verse 6, where it says, "For unto us a child is born, and a son is given. His name shall be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace." one of the, well, the interpretation that, you know, that was given to us was that here it states that, see, a son is going to be given to us, which is referring to Jesus, but it says that his name is going to be the Everlasting Father. So, I mean, now I know as a Catholic and profess to believe in the Trinity that that's, you know, that's absurd.
So what's the proper, what is a Catholic reading of that? Is that what we're working towards, Jafet?
Yes, I guess that's what I'm trying to say.
Okay, so what is a Catholic reading of that, Jimmy?
So the, there are a couple of different ways of approaching this. There's not an official church teaching about how to understand this verse. The church obviously has this in her Bible, and it's even been very prominent in the history of Messianic prophecy and in Christian art. I mean, this is a, there's a whole musical setting of this that's used in Handel's Messiah, for example. And so, in terms of how to handle it vis-a-vis the oneness question, there is a, I can see two basic approaches. The first basic approach would be to say that here we have an affirmation of the Son of God or Christ's divinity. And it's emphasizing that he is the mighty God and he is one in being with the Eternal Father. He's a distinct person from the Eternal Father, but that's a distinction that this verse is not trying to make because the Trinity had not yet been clearly revealed at this time. We had the Old Testament affirmation of monotheism, and we also had a recognition in various passages in the Old Testament that there's, even within the one God, there's some kind of plurality that suggests there may be more than one person. This is a Jewish doctrine that was sometimes called the two powers in heaven doctrine. And, or you have, it's, you sometimes have references to Yahweh and the second Yahweh that's somehow God, but also somehow distinct from the regular Yahweh. And so we do have intimations of the Trinity in the Old Testament, but we don't have the doctrine clearly announced yet. Not all of the data has been given. And so this verse, while reflecting the divinity of Christ, doesn't reflect all of the different aspects of the Trinity. Now, that's one way of approaching this verse. The second way of approaching this verse is based on the metaphor of fatherhood, because fatherhood was something that you could use not just in reference to God and not just in reference to your biological father, but also in reference to leaders. For example, there's one point where a person is talking to a Levite, and since Levites were spiritual leaders, the guy in the Old Testament says, "You'll be a father to me." Also, there was an official who we read about later in the book of Isaiah, in Isaiah chapter 22, who was the chief steward or chamberlain of the house of David. He ran the palace on David's behalf. And one of the things God says about this figure is that this official will be a father to the people in Jerusalem. So he's going to look out for them. He's going to protect them. He's going to take care of them, things like that. And if you could apply this metaphor of fatherhood even to one of the king's officials, you could certainly apply it to the king himself. And so here in this passage, we have a prophesied coming king, and it by saying he's going to be called Eternal Father, that doesn't necessarily mean he's going to be called God the Father. It may just mean he's going to perform this fatherly role for people. He's going to look out for his subjects. He's going to take care of his subjects. He's going to guide and discipline his subjects the same way a father does. And he's always going to do that. So that's what would be meant by the everlasting part. And obviously, there's different ways to translate the Hebrew there. But the idea could be that he's simply always going to perform a fatherly role. You could call him the everlasting shepherd. And it would mean basically the same thing, since a shepherd has a relationship to the sheep that's a little bit like the relationship a father has to the children he guides. And so it it could be a mistake to say this is automatically a reference to God the Father. So those would be the two basic approaches I'd propose. The first one would simply acknowledge that this is emphasizing his divinity, but without clearly making all the distinctions among the persons of the Trinity, because the doctrine hasn't been fully announced yet. And secondly, it may be a mistake to assume that this is a reference to God the Father when it refers to a more general guiding and providing for function that the Messianic King will have for the people of Israel.
Japhet, I hope that that is helpful to you. Appreciate the call. Thank you. I'm going to try to get at least one more in before we have to conclude this hour. And those who are on the line, hang on, because this is not the last hour. Jimmy's going to be with us for another hour for Open Forum. Let's go to Jason in Michigan watching on YouTube Live. Jason, you there with us?
Hello?
Oh, hi, Jason. How are you?
Well, good. Thank you. Jimmy, I'm very glad that you're the one on the phone. I got your book, The Fathers Know Best, and it's my first gift I give to anyone I'm having a dialogue with, so I really appreciate you.
Oh, wow. Thank you.
So my question... Thank you. The question I have is, in Pope Francis's new encyclical, chapter 8, paragraph 271, he quotes the bishops of India saying the goal of dialogue is to establish friendship, peace, harmony, and sharing spiritual and moral values and experiences in a spirit of truth and love. Mm-hmm. And while I was reading the whole encyclical itself, it kind of gave me the idea that we shouldn't be going into a dialogue with the hope of conversion. And so I'm just wondering, you know, what is really the feeling on that?
Well, different people have different feelings about it, but I would say that we want everybody to receive the fullness of the gospel. And so we want everybody to come to Jesus Christ and experience the fullness of his grace and truth in this life, if possible. And so, you know, it's not at all unreasonable to talk to people and hope that they will come to embrace the Christian faith. That doesn't mean that we need to shove it down their throats or that we should be deceptive about it. And, you know, that in not every situation in life when we're talking to someone, should we be aggressively evangelizing? If you're ordering a pizza for dinner, and every time the pizza delivery man comes to your door, you tell him about Jesus, even though he's not responding to it, you're probably going to turn him away from Jesus by making Christians sound like fanatics. And so in the ordering a pizza situation, you don't want to be overly aggressive in evangelizing. And the same thing is true in formal interreligious dialogues. If you have a group of Catholic scholars and, say, a group of Hindu scholars, and they're talking to each other as part of clarifying our points of difference and our points of commonality, well, that's the function of that meeting, is to clarify points of agreement and points of difference. That the function of that meeting is not for one side to evangelize the other, just like the function of ordering a pizza is not to evangelize the person you're ordering the pizza from. The function of the conversation is to get a pizza. And so consequently, if you try to hijack an encounter that has one purpose and unnaturally make it try to serve some other purpose, then you're likely to drive people away and you're being manipulative and you shouldn't do that. That's not the same thing as saying, hey, I want to share the truth of the gospel with you and I hope you become Christian. That's perfectly legitimate. The question is, are you doing that in a natural, honest way, or are you doing it in some kind of manipulative way?
Jason, I hope that's helpful to you. Thanks so much for the question. Those who are on the line, hang on the line. We're going to come right back with Jimmy, and we will get to your questions. If you haven't called yet and you'd like to give it a try, there's just one line open, but you can see if you can get in there, 888-318-7884. Jimmy Akin, senior apologist here at Catholic Answers, is our guest this hour. And the topic, well, that's up to you. It's open forum. As Jimmy said, call from anywhere in the world as well. Any question is welcome. Any person is welcome. Any geography, welcome. 888-318-7884.